This episode was recorded on June 9th, 2020. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of our special season of The Challengers. This week on the podcast, I'm honored to be joined by activist, filmmaker, and my very dear friend, Will Halby. Will is one of the executive directors of Zeno Mountain Farm, an incredible organization that hosts camps and retreats for adults and children with and without disabilities. Together, we talk about Zeno, disability culture, and Will's journey toward creating meaningful art that makes a difference. I love this conversation, and I know you will too. Enjoy. Okay, so I am so excited with the guest that we have today. He is, in fact, one of the co-founders and co-directors of Zeno Mountain Farm. He is a filmmaker. He's an activist. He is the father of four and the husband of an incredible woman. Will Halby, welcome to The Challengers.
Hi.
Hi. So... yeah, I mean, what's interesting is when I thought about you coming on, again, the pre-quarantine challengers have a very different quality from these. These are a little bit looser and present and filmed, and so we have to, like, you know, put on clean shirts and stuff like that. If you came on the audio one, you could have just totally worn your dirty shirt. But I think about, like, you as somebody who has looked at your own challenges, had experiences with personal challenges and making changes in your life, and you are really one of the most honest and self-reflective people that I know. And I'm interested in, if there's any global way of answering this question, or maybe not, but, like, how did the experience of looking at your own challenges lead you to the work that you do now, to your philosophy of the world? I mean, you, and also before I kick it to you, it's funny when you and I have connected on the Repro Rights space and the work that I'm pretty involved in there. And I remember you reaching out about something I'd done or something that was going on in the news. I honestly can't remember what. And I had this initial feeling, which I'm sure my, you know, Black Americans feel when somebody like me says, like, I'm learning, you know, it's like, are you for real? Like, are you, because you've never had your, you know, abortion, you've never had an abortion. So do you really? And then the more I know you, it's like your understanding of, well, first of all, you have never dominated conversation. So it's more like your support, but also your insight into, I mean, that word I keep coming back to is the intersectionality, how these things, how anybody who's not in that dominant culture, you know, be it economically, gender-wise, is affected in a similar way to differing degrees, depending on privilege and situation. So again, I want to keep honoring that. But I was like, oh, he's for real. Like, he has some insights into how these things fit together. So anything, any jumping off point?
I don't know. I think what has always driven me is well, two things. One is a fascination with people and life and things other than my own. And from a very young age, I always sort of sought out the weirdos and the people that sort of lived on the fringes of not just society, you know, socioeconomically, but just culturally. Like you know, the people that I was always drawn to were the people that came at life from a different angle.
And what was your, and because again, I'm getting to know you and your brother, Peter, who is also a director at Zeno. What was, were you privileged white? I know you grew up in the suburb of Boston. Were you privileged? Were you, I mean, you're obviously a white male. Like, did you, were you like, oh, my upbringing says I should be in tennis whites, but I'm going over here? Or did you come from kind of a diverse, you know, activist family?
Yeah, no, I definitely qualify as a privileged white guy.
Tennis whites guy.
Yeah, I mean, if you looked up privileged white guy in the dictionary, it would be me. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know where that came from. I think I was definitely bored with sort of my upbringing. I always wanted something different. You know, when I hit my teenage years, I bought a van and I tricked it out, and I'm still doing that actually. You know, I'm building this bus that I'm renovating. But I bought a van and I made it a little camper. And every summer, my friends and I we'd work sort of half the summer, make as much money as we could, and then we just hit the road. You know, and this was in the early 90s when there was no connection with anybody. You know, and it's funny to think back because we would just go. We'd say, "Mom, we're going on a road trip," and we would go everywhere. We'd go to New Mexico, we'd go to Florida, we'd go to Louisiana, and we were always drawn. And I was always very wanting to go to gatherings and places. So we would go to the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally, you know, which is this massive motorcycle rally in South Dakota. And I just wanted to be there. You know, I wasn't riding motorcycles at the time or anything. I just wanted to be there around all these people that were just kind of being wild. And then we'd go on tour with the Grateful Dead. But we'd also go down to Louisiana and just sort of immerse ourselves into the scene down there as best we could. And I think I've always been absolutely fascinated by just different kinds of people that come at the world in a different way. And I think that's what, when I discovered a camp on Martha's Vineyard that was for people with disabilities, it was everything that I wanted. It was a group of people that were living together and caring for each other. And I think living together was really the key thing too, because it was full immersion. And I just fell in love with disability culture because it was everybody was thinking and moving and creating in ways that were entirely unique to themselves. And then we had to do things together and figure out how to integrate. And I found the art and the community and everything was so much better because of all that stuff. And we use that. We talk about that a lot. We say, you know, the art that we create is good because of disability rather than in spite of it, which I think is sort of the way, it's a flip on the way disability is often talked about, where it's sort of like, oh my God, this person did this even though, and we're just, we sort of come at it from the completely opposite way, where say like, this is, you know, because of who they are is because why it's so interesting and fascinating. What people need is the vehicle and the spotlight to have the opportunity to be themselves and to share their gifts. So that was something else I found, like, as I got older, that I really enjoyed doing, was creating those communities and creating those environments where people can shine. So Amy came to, for all of you who don't know this, Amy came to our camp last summer in July, and she came for the last week of camp when we do our musical performance. And it's about 70 people all living together in cabins. And the only thing we're focused on for the last 2 weeks of camp, but particularly last week of camp when Amy was there, when you were there, what is play. And we eat, drink, and sleep the play. We wake up and we sing the songs at breakfast. We do the dishes so that we can get to rehearsal. We work so hard in an often hot theater. And what I think is fascinating about it is the level of work that it takes to do that and to really, really work hard on something and to push people. There's always a point during the play week when everybody's really mad at me, you know, because I'm pushing people really hard and I'm asking people to really work harder than they probably would want to. Everybody wants to go to the pond and swim and hang out. And even though everybody's kind of mad at me, I always feel like I've accomplished something in that moment, because it's sort of like, oh, we've created something that matters here. Yeah. You know, people really care. They're feeling torn. They're passionate about something. You know, people will want a bigger part and that I think is sort of what is really cool is when I sort of get the privilege of creating an environment where things matter, where we're a part of something bigger than ourselves. And I think that's something that we all crave so much, to be a part of something bigger than ourselves. And what's cool is I think you can create that within your house, within your community, if you just really, really make things matter, just elevate everything that we're doing.
There's so many things I want to riff off of. I mean, one is reflecting on Cornerstone, on the theater company that I helped to co-found out of college, and the living together piece. You know, I think we can all be sort of polite for a certain amount of time, right? It's like a teacher. Imagine a teacher dealing with like 20 kindergartners, and they can, you know, be on their, or do great. I mean, be on their best behavior, be positive, whatever, and then go home and have a scotch and go like, oh my God, you know? I feel like when you don't, I mean, and there are outlets and people can disappear. And that was actually one of the questions, because I was there with Charlotte and she does need that downtime. So I was asking people, hey, she and I were sort of holed up in a room, but I said, if she was there without me, how do people get downtime? And people figure it out, because that's a human need. You know, just speaking personally, I don't know if you remember, but that when Charlotte spoke that last morning we were there, so there was an incident. Not Savannah. What was her name? Anyway, there was this woman who was just really, now Zeno's super touchy and Char likes to touch when she likes to touch. And then she gets over, I mean, this is kind of part of her nervous system, right? So we were all backstage and she got this big hug and Charlotte just kind of went like, ah!
Well, Sequoia.
And Sequoia, and I turned around and Sequoia had like tears in her eyes. And I said, hey, just so you know, try not to take that personally. When Charlotte gets overstimulated, a touch can be too much, right? Mm-hmm. And she was like, okay, because she's the touch. And I was like, well, this is one of those moments of, you know, talking it through. And so Zeno, and before every meal, I think really people would get up, make announcements, this and that. Sometimes they'd be logistical. Sometimes they'd be at somebody's birthday or it's a lot more heartfelt, you know? So I said to Char, I was like, you know, you don't have to do this, but it might be great because in this community where people are being really honest and saying, hey, that's too loud or my feelings were hurt. You could say, just so you know, sometimes touches are too much and that's just me. And, you know, and she didn't reject it. She didn't take it in. And then it took a couple of meals and then she did. And I was like, wow, it doesn't get any better, right? Than being in community. And it's not all kumbaya, like you're saying. And I think the other piece, obviously, which is at the kind of the subtext of everything you're saying, and as a mother of now a 19-year-old and going through IEPs and special ed, and I'm writing a play about it because it's so interesting to me. Even super, super well-intentioned people basically look at special needs disability. It's like, oh, those poor people. And I'm kind of saintly. And even things like, you know, best buddies or Special Olympics, again, well-intentioned, great, you know, thank God there were those opportunities before there was nothing, right? There was institutions. But I think now, again, it's part of another marginalized group going like, no, like we're not less than, don't give us pity. And so I think pushing and saying like, you know, no, not every effort is going to be celebrated. Like do better, learn your lines. You know, you have expectations as you would for any performer. Mm-hmm. And it's sadly surprising when that is demanded of, in my experience, just as an observer, you know, either it's like, you know, somebody like Charlotte, where it's like, we're eking it out in neurotypical world and non-disabled world, but secretly she's not getting her needs met, or the binary thing is you're over there. It's changing. But I think that, and then the last thing I want, and I would love for you to talk about this too, what was really honestly, even though I knew about Zeno and I'm in disability world and through my family, the physical experience of being there, the physical experience. AJ and I talked about this. I said, oh, you know, we spent time in Zeno, and he said, you fed me. And I said, oh, that's right, I did, you know. But then he articulated what it is when you have a meal with somebody who can't get the food to their mouth, you assist them with that. And at first it's weird, just because we don't get to do that a lot. And I sat with Judy one for lunch once, and you know, Judy's the same way. So I turned to Charlotte and I said, do you want to help feed Judy? And she had a very typical teenager, like, hey, like that's weird. And I was like, no worries. And then midway through, she's like, I'll do it. I was like, yeah, I don't think it's, a, you know, we don't get that physical experience of touching bodies, helping, you know, obviously it needs to be safe. It needs to be appropriate. It needs to be all these things. But it's life-changing because we're so isolated so much of the time. So how did that grow? How did that kind of way of, is that, was that, how do you make sure people are safe and not, again, that there's a flow between who needs help? How did that all, how'd you figure that out?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually that's the easy stuff. Let me say about that interaction between Sequoia and Charlotte. Like, I think that's such a perfect example of what I'm talking about, where, you know, things like that happen and they matter, you know, and it's a moment that needs to be thought about, because Charlotte needs, you know, she has to, her needs have to be met. But at the same time, they were backstage ready to go on to play. So it's sort of like, oh, okay, so this is everything is sort of the right size. You know what I mean? Right. Like that happened, but we still have, we have this other thing that's really important. So we're going to go and do our thing. And then when the time is right, we're going to talk about it. We're going to acknowledge it. And it sort of brings up this idea that we talk about a lot with, that's the dignity of risk. That, you know, like, just Charlotte as an example, like her, she has needs, like we all do. But there's needs that don't often get met in the sort of the special ed model of needs of sort of like going out to an edge of something, like where, you know, where's the edge of safety? Like, you know, we want to be safe, but we want to know, like, where do I get to try something out? You know,
right.
Say something that, you know, I wouldn't get to say in another environment. And I think that's something that we like to explore, you know, to give people, like, we're all here for the most part. We're all adults. Let's bounce off each other, you know, and knowing that we are part of something bigger and that we need to function as a community, and let's be okay with taking some risks. And let's let everybody have the experience of that.
Well, I do feel like it's a little microcosm for, you know, in my rabid concern, I'm listening to this thing called Girl Trek, which is having this Black History Month. Like, it's like, I tune in and I, so there's this interesting thing right now, you know, as a white woman, it's like, do you, I mean, mostly I get to shut up and learn right now. Mostly I get to shut up, learn, support. Like, that is, see, I mean, I know I'm honored to do what I'm doing to contribute that way. But it's also, you know, there's a point where it's like difficult conversations have to be had, you know, and I just don't think we have a lot of models, because think how many times in normal culture, it's like somebody hurts feelings and a friendship ends. You know what I mean? It just happens all the time, you know, or it's like, oh, I don't like that teacher. And then, yeah, I don't want my kid to have that teacher. And I'm going to say, like, that teacher's bad. Or it's like, there's literally not a time, you know, that's why we all, you know, rush to therapy when we do, or couples counseling, whatever, because we don't have models for, like, I feel this way. I feel strongly this way. You know, well, I feel strongly this way, you know, and then just to be in discomfort, you know, I think that's another theme that's coming up right now. And I just think there's so many opportunities, you know, at a place like Zeno, and it needs to happen a lot more, right? We need to be uncomfortable. But we need to know, to your beautiful language, we're part of something bigger, you know? So my discomfort is in service of something. It's worth it. It's worth it, you know? All right, I'm going to ask some questions, because these are really super sweet people that are, okay. Paula says, do you think technology helps to make activism more effective? How do you expect the current movements affect the next generations? I mean, people are fighting together for justice and equal rights in the middle of a pandemic. That's it. Because also what I flashed on when you were talking about going around in your van in the early 90s, and this was true of Cornerstone too, there wasn't any social media. So there wasn't at all, like, I mean, there might be, I'm going to take a picture to make an album, but there wasn't any dig me, check me out. So that's the downside. The good side is that things go viral, and things that need to go viral go viral. But what's your instinct? Do you think technology helps to make activism more effective?
I think that the democratization of information, I think, is a real interesting thing with this. You know, everyone's opinion, it's such a double-edged sword, because everyone's opinion matters. I think there's so much out there, there's so much information, that it's having a hard time, you know, convalescing around things. You know, there's and I think we're craving a catalyst, and I think we see a catalyst like the murder video of George Floyd, and it explodes. And I think with social media and just the massive amount of information and the incredible amount of opinions, those things are harder to come by. You look back at leaders, you brought up civil rights, you know, and it's like those were defined by their leaders, you know, Martin Luther King. Like there were people that sort of were the symbol of that. And I don't, that's not happening as much.
This is so beautiful. Megan, what is the most effective way to fight depression? What would you say?
Oh, I think, there's different, we throw around depression pretty loosely, I think, because there's different kinds of depression. There's clinical depression, where the best way to fight it is to get help, professional help. And that sometimes includes medication. And I think that just needs to be said, because I've struggled with it. And but there's also just to get out of your head. I mean, I think that's what we all want, is to get out of our heads. And the best way to get out of one's head is to be of service to other people, to be a part of something bigger than ourselves. To not think about myself is the best way to feel good. And I'm so blessed with you know, it's everywhere. I mean, I don't have time to think about myself, because we have four little kids and I'm running a camp, and there's just, you know, which is great. And that's the way I like it. And I think that's originally, just to bring it back to how we started this conversation, I think that's why I was attracted, you know, to the, and I use weird, in the highest, you know, that's my highest compliment. You know, that's why I was always attracted, because I'm a weirdo. I'd like to seek out that, I think, because it took me out of my head, because right. I felt like I was part of something. Like, this is cool. Like, this is not me. I'm not trapped in my brain thinking about, you know, the narcissistic things that we think about. I'm this is, things are happening. It's exciting, you know?
Oh my God. All right. I'm going to ask you this thing. We close out every episode with asking you, not you, but who, I am a challenge. Finish the sentence. I am a challenger because.
I am a challenger because I always am seeking something to take me out of my head. I think it's right what we were just talking about. You know, I'm cursed with self, the burden of self. I acknowledge that it's an unhealthy place for me to be stuck in my head. But paradoxically, and I think this is to your point about what a challenge is, it's not something something that enhances your life once you get through it. Is that it's brought me to these communities. Like, it's brought me to the burden of wanting to get out of myself and get out of my head. It has brought me to, you know, the people that I care about the most and the people that interest me the most and this type of art and friendships that mean things.
I love that. And there are those that get out of their head by buying another car, or I'm going to renovate another house. Mm-hmm. And I think that, the way you have chosen to get out of your head is also really beautiful. And I share it as well. It's like the water wheel of I need something. Love you, Will Halby.
I love you.
All right.
So much fun.
Thanks for coming on. Stay safe and give my love to everybody.
I will. You too.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the podcast. If you'd like to join us for the live versions, you can follow me on my socials @AmyBrenneman on all platforms. I'll talk to you soon.